Order, please.
This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is Friday, April 18th. It's approximately 8:14 in the morning. Representative Foster? Representative Foster is right outside. We have Representative Davis, Kelly, myself, Terrio, Mulder, and Martin. We have two bills on the schedule this morning. The first we're going to take up is HB 11, dealing with driver's license requirements for minors, and then HB 158, the right to attend school on a part-time basis. Representative Hanley and myself have to go to a meeting downstairs, so I've asked Representative Mulder to chair the meeting this morning. And with that, I guess I'll go to Representative Mulder to get started.
Jeff, we'll start this morning, I guess, with HB 11. Mr. Logan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jeff Logan, legislative assistant to Representative Joe Green, the sponsor of House Bill 11. Mr. Chairman, in going through some notes last night, preparing my introduction to the committee for this morning, I noted that I was still looking at House Bill 11, not a CS for House Bill 11. The bill has been through two committees this year, and I counted that since the bill was first introduced in the 18th legislature, this bill has gone through 10 committee hearings. And so, for the most part, it has stood the public scrutiny. The version that you see before you now, I think, is a version that has met the test of the House anyway. This bill received 37 votes last year on the House floor. And so I will quickly go through, Mr. Chairman, what this act does. The first section of the bill amends the restriction on the issuance of a driver's license to include a provisional driver's license for drivers between 16 and 18 years old. Section 2 increases the age that a person must be to accompany a person holding an instructional permit to 22 years old. From now on, if this legislation passes, you would have to be 22 years old to be accompanying, at least 22 years old to be accompanying somebody with an instructional permit. The third section establishes the provisional driver's license. This is something that I know I've spoken to with most of you. When I do say the bill is in pretty good shape, I have to credit Representative Gary Davis, who the last two years was the chairman of the Transportation Committee and really helped to get the bill in the shape that it is now, so I know that Representative Davis is very familiar with it. But, Mr. Chairman, essentially, a provisional driver's license is also known as a graduated license. The concept is to graduate young drivers into driverhood so they don't just show up one day at the DMV when they turn 16, hop in a car, and hit the streets. The idea is to teach good driving habits along the way, give them a restricted license so that they don't have full driving privileges for the first year, and then hopefully during that time they will they'll learn good driving habits, will graduate on to be a better driver. And Section 3 establishes that provisional driver's license, and it says that the department may issue a provisional license to an applicant between the ages of 16 and 18 if the applicant has held an instructional permit. And that is the first stage, the first piece of the progression, if you will, that from now on, in order to receive a driver's license, a driver will have to have had an instructional permit. That is the reason we are increasing the age of the person who accompanies the instructional permitted driver to be an older driver. Older drivers are generally safer drivers. They have more driving skills. The hope is that if we put the young driver with somebody who is a safer, more skilled driver, that they'll learn better driving habits. The second part of Section 3, and I'm looking pretty much in the middle of page 2 of the bill, establishes who is required to hold the provisional license. For those of you who have followed this bill along, we have scaled this down quite a bit. The way the bill reads now is that the applicant between 16 and 18, this is an applicant for a driver's license, may not be issued an unrestricted driver's license until they have held an instructional permit for 6 months and a provisional license for 1 year. Between 16 and 18, before you are issued an unrestricted license, you must have held a provisional, graduated, restricted driver's license. And it also establishes that a driver with a provisional license may not operate a motor vehicle between the hours of 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. This is kind of the hook of the bill. This is how we are restricting these young drivers by restricting the hours of when they can drive, except, and again, Representative Gary Davis had the effect on this, in the 18th legislature as a member of the State Affairs Committee. We had a more sweeping restriction with expressing concern for the seafood processing workers in his district, we narrowed this down to where you can't be driving between 1 and 5 unless you're driving from work to home. So for these young people who do have nighttime jobs, it's still not a violation for them to drive on the most direct route between their place of employment and their home. Section 4 allows the department to suspend, revoke, or deny an instructional permit or provisional license for the accumulation of 8 or more points in a 12-month period. So not only are we restricting the time when a young driver can drive, but we are saying that they have to do a better job while they're out there on the road. They don't get as many points as other drivers do. And then Section 5, simply conforming definitional language. Mr. Chairman, the sponsor initially introduced what was then House Bill 430 in the 18th legislature in response to constituent requests and his observation that young drivers were disproportionately represented in driving statistics of accidents, crashes, and fatalities. And initially, we considered a requirement that all young drivers had to go through a driver's education training program. There were obviously logistical problems with that in rural areas of the state. And about that time, the Congress passed the High-Risk Drivers Act of 1993, which included incentives for states to pass legislation like this, financial incentives, to help do that. I think it's 11 states now. I just handed out an article that was, it's fairly recent. It's October from USA Today. It also appeared in the Anchorage Daily News. And it lists some current information about this. Also, Mr. Chairman, Nita Hensley from DMV is here today. And Nita is very active with a National Association of Driver's License Administrators. As a matter of fact, I think Nita is the chairman or the president of it. And she can give you some idea of what other states are doing as well. When the bill was initially introduced in the 18th legislature, Alaska was kind of on the forefront of this concept. In intervening 2.5 years, a number of other states have gone ahead and adopted language like this or even stricter, and we find ourselves now playing catch-up to some extent. And, Mr. Chairman, I would simply like to close by stating that I hope members did get a chance to look through the letters of support for the legislation. There was quite a broad group of Alaskans, from the congressional delegation to MAD to the Alaska Truckers Association, highway safety groups, and others who support this legislation. It is shown to have worked. I have two file packets here of information, some of it from other states. It's been enacted in Oregon, and they've done an extensive study there and shown that it did make a difference. It did keep 16 and 17-year-olds, especially males, out of accidents. There have been other states that have enacted the law and have done studies. It's been enacted in other political jurisdictions in Canada. Ontario has the law. It's been enacted in New Zealand and been shown to be effective. I won't bore you with that unless you're interested in it, but just to say in closing that this is something that has been shown to work. It made it through the House last year and died in the rush to adjournment and Senate rules, and we're hoping that the committee will look favorably this year so we can get it to the House floor and get it to the other side and hopefully this year get it passed.
Thank you for being brief, Mr. Logan. Representative Foster?
Yes, sir. I was wondering, I remember going through this, was it last year, the year before or something? Yeah. But, you know, I've got 30 villages in my district stretching along 400 miles of coastline, and 29 of the villages only have, like, one car. Some of the villages don't even have any cars, but for those that do have one, they pick up the mail from the airport and bring it to town, which is probably 500 yards. But now for a kid to help his dad do it, as it stands now, he has to fly into Nome. Let's say you're from Savungur Gamble or something, and you're talking $100 to get in town, $100 to get back, and probably a day or two in Nome. And this bill would mean that he'd have to go 3 times just to get a driver's license. Is that correct?
Juanita?
Yeah. And I'm not so much talking about Nome, but, you know, I've got villages down in Lower Yukon. I got to fly to Bethel or Anchorage.
Where's Nome?
To get to Bethel. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Juanita Hensley. I'm the Chief of Driver Services for the Division of Motor Vehicles. Through the chair, Representative Martin, the areas that do not have access to
He's wearing my mustache today.
That was a compliment. Representative Martin, those villages that you represent that do not have access to a full-fledged DMV office have the availability of coming to my office here in Juneau, believe it or not, and we issue driver's licenses through the mail to those individuals. We send them out their written exam by mail. They take the written exam. It's usually proctored by someone in the village. And they mail it back to us along with their fee. We grade the test, and then we send them out a restricted driver's license that allows them to drive in that community without having to take a full-fledged road test. Now, if they want to go into Nome, or if they want to go to Bethel, or going even into Anchorage, before they can drive in those communities, they have to take the behind-the-wheel test to show their proficiency of driving in traffic. But we do issue a restricted, it's called an off-systems driver's license to those individuals, and that's all across the state where they do not have access to a DMV office or a commission agent. So that they could get the license and it's strictly a process through the mail. They would not have to go into Nome three different times.
Now for, is there like nighttime testing since most of the accidents occur at night?
Through the chair, the nighttime restriction would be the same restriction out in those communities. But if they're working with their father or something, there is a provision in this bill that will allow them to go to and from work. Or if they're with their parent, they can certainly be out at that time. There would be no violation.
Because in the wintertime, it's dark all the time up there.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, in the wintertime, it's dark all the time.
Well, what we mean by that is no driving between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Yeah, okay.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Logan or Ms. Hensley? Representative Davies?
Actually, Ms. Hensley, perhaps you'd be the best one to answer. Is there a definition in statutes or in your regulations about what vehicular way means?
Yes, there is. Through the chair, Representative Davies, there certainly is, and I've got my book here, and I can read it to you. It's actually a vehicular way or area. As a definition under AS 2840-100, number 24, vehicular way or area means a way, path, or other area than a highway or private property that is designated by official traffic control devices or customary usage and that is open to the public for purposes of pedestrian or vehicular travel, and which way or area may be restricted in use to pedestrians, bicycles, or other specific types of vehicles as determined by a department or other agency having jurisdiction over the path or area. That would be roads within.
So it means other than a highway?
Yeah, other than a highway. Highway has a definition in the statutes of meaning an entire width between boundary lines of every way that is publicly maintained when a part of it is open to the public for the purposes of vehicular travel, including but not limited to every street and Alaska State Marine Highway System, but not vehicular ways or areas.
The reason for my question is that this is one of those sort of quibbles that, like, sometimes we cause ourselves problems in the statutes with these little words or. And in here it says that on page 2, line 25 and 26, it's the requirement of going back home the most direct way. And it says along the most direct highway, vehicular way, or area. And I can envision a situation where there's a vehicular way that's available and a highway that's available, and the highway might not be the most direct route, but since it says or here, they could be going on the highway. So I don't know if that's a problem or not, but
through the chair, Representative Davies, that's pretty standard throughout in any of the statutes.
Just wondered if there wasn't some term that included all those things to say by the most direct route available or something like that, and then you wouldn't get to have the or problem.
I would think, Representative Davies, would be a logical problem in the sense that if someone gets stopped between 1 and 5 in the morning, that there's probably a problem in the first place before they're going to get stopped. And if they would get stopped, the officer is not would have a good idea between where they're going and whether he wanted to push the issue. So I think it's more of a logical one, but it is a good point. Representative Green, did you want to respond?
Yes, Chairman. The other thing, Representative Davies, is that It's possible in the wintertime that the highway, even though it might be slightly longer, would be a far safer route than a vehicular way, which may not be maintained. And so this would allow that person to go the most safe direct way home.
So you actually intend the order to be utilized?
Yes.
In that case. Okay, fine.
Thank you. Representative Martin?
Yes, Juanita Owen had one question. A young person contacted me yesterday, and evidently they're interested in their driving license. He was also interested in his freedom to experiment. He felt it was unreasonable if he should get 2 speeding tickets that it would be 8 points. I thought that sounded rather reasonable. I'd take your license away the first time. What is this? Is this within the normal frame? Is it 8 points and without a license for how long?
Through this chair, Representative Martin, 8 points is fairly substantial. 12 points, it's 12 points now for any age driver. They accumulate 12 points in a 12-month period, their license is suspended for a period of 1 month. The same would happen with this. If you're a youth driver and you get 8 points in a one-year period, the license would be suspended for a one-month period. Two speeding tickets would mean, to get to that 8 points, would mean that that person was going between 10 and 19 miles over the over the posted limit. And that would mean that they were actually convicted of those offenses as well. We have two programs in Alaska that have just now started up. They're safe driving type programs that a person can go to and they can get their point accumulation reduced by two if they choose to take the course. These courses have been approved through my office for the reduction of points on someone. So if they get a speeding ticket, say a 4-point speeding ticket, they can go and take the defensive driving course. And the courses that have been approved are geared towards youth and driving. So, and they can, and it gears towards that age group, and they can reduce their point total by two. So if they get a 4-point ticket, they can reduce their overall total to only a 2-point. And you can take that once a year. Okay. So to get traffic tickets or to get tickets, you're doing something fairly wrong. And I know there's a lot of people that do. But
I kind of agree with you now. He explained, said, you're only going 75 in a 55-mile zone. What's wrong with that? I said, only? I said, man, if I'm walking across the street with my white cane, I don't want to see you. So, but it's different perception, but I'm glad you explained that. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Jeff or Ms. Hensley? All right. We also have signed up to testify this morning. We have several folks on teleconference and a couple folks here in town. We'll take the first one in town, John George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George, and I'm here today representing the National Association of Independent Insurers, Property Casualty Trade Association, that includes a number of companies that write automobile insurance in the state of Alaska. We have supported this bill not only in Alaska but throughout the United States. As Jeff testified earlier, it has been adopted very similar laws in other states, and we have seen that it has made a substantial difference in the number of accidents and deaths of young drivers. But let me give you a different perspective. I'm also the assistant fire chief in the Auk Bay District, and I get those calls at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, automobile accident. You go out there and you find generally that you have two cases. You have inexperienced drivers or you have drunk drivers at that time. And often you have an inexperienced driver that gets run into by a drunk driver. I have a 15-and-a-half-year-old daughter who in June will get her driver's license, and I've also, in my own mind, tried to put this in the perspective of, well, how would this affect my daughter? My daughter doesn't get in trouble. She gets good grades. She's a great kid, not a bad kid. And often this bill has been looked at as, well, this will keep those juvenile delinquents off the road at 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't see that at all. This applies to every kid. She needed to be instructed by someone who was a good driver, who had a lot of experience, and get her 6 months under a learner's permit so that she really had the technical expertise to drive. She's within a month now of getting her license, but she doesn't still have the experience that's needed to be out with five kids in the back seat driving out 2 o'clock in the morning. This bill would restrict her during the early morning hours when it's very dangerous to drive, when the drunks are out there, and when we typically see, in the fire department, we typically see the really bad accidents, the ones that are fatal accidents. So from my own daughter's standpoint, I think this is a great bill. She has had the experience driving with someone under a learner's permit, and for the first year, while she gets more experience, she will be restricted from driving from 1 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the morning. I think that's entirely reasonable, and hopefully that will protect her and her friends. I also look at this from the standpoint she rides with her friends. I don't want her riding with her 16-year-old friends at 1 to 5 in the morning because I know that's a very dangerous time for her. I'll go get her if she has to be out at that time in the morning.
Representative Foster and then Representative Martin.
So this bill would bring down the insurance rates for kids then?
I believe it would, from the standpoint that the rates are based on the losses. Mm-hmm. And to the extent it brings down the losses, it should bring down the insurance for youthful drivers. So it won't be overnight, but I think you'll see a trend, downward trend in the accidents, and therefore I think it will affect the youthful driver insurance rate.
Should be done at the
Representative Martin?
Mr. George, I'm pleased to have you here because insurance is extremely important to parents as well as to the young drivers, and especially those who are working and going to school or college. I think they need to be a lot more aware of what it may cost them, not just for a ticket and have to go to class, but what is the average insurance now for a young person, male or female, when they're first learning, 16 or 17, and then do you or your insurance colleagues give any special instruction to youth and let them know, look, one accident, this is it, two accidents, this is it, three accidents, no insurance? How do you work that out with the parents and the young drivers?
Okay, Representative Martin through the chair. I would just have to give you a number off the top of my head for an average increase. It depends so much on individual circumstances, what the insurance is, whether they're included under their parents' insurance, whether they have their own insurance, whether they're driving a brand new Corvette or a 1953 Plymouth station wagon, and I don't know. It is expensive. I mm-hmm. can assure you that particularly male drivers, because they tend to have more accidents, mm-hmm. do pay a lot of insurance. Female drivers pay less because they seem to be less aggressive in their driving and therefore don't. Interesting story. My son, when he turned 16, was complaining about how these youthful drivers used to pay so much insurance. And he was also a cadet in our fire department. And after a year, I asked him, I said, well, you've been to a lot of accidents now. How many involved young drivers? Well, about 80%. I said, how many of those were drunk? He said, about 90%. I said, okay. I said, you see now why youthful drivers pay so much. I said, but I'll make you a deal. I'll pay your insurance until you get your first ticket. Kid's 24 years old.
So that's the advice you give parents.
That's right. Yeah, well, at least yeah, I do. And I'm real proud of him, the fact that he's probably a more careful driver than I am. He's also now an EMT with the fire department in Fairbanks, and he goes to a lot worse accidents than I do.
Is insurance also predicated not only in an accident, but if an individual does get a ticket for speeding or reckless driving, you're notified about that for the
yes.
insurance company?
Yes. And as far as education that insurance companies do for youthful drivers, I guess there may be some companies that do a better job than others. I guess I can't testify today as to what actually happens. I think it's generally known that if you have a bad driving record, you will pay a lot more insurance. Certainly, when I was the director of insurance, we used to get calls from parents who had teenagers with a couple of accidents and a couple of tickets, and they were either being increased substantially in their insurance rates or being canceled, and what could they do? I think it's generally known that, yes, if you have a problem like that, it becomes a problem with your insurance. But as far as educational thing, I guess I can't testify as to what generally would happen.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. George? If not, thank you for being
thank
here
you.
This morning. We'll go to the teleconference for the members here. We do have online this morning Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, Matsu, Petersburg, and Kenny Lake is listening. First, we'll go to Anchorage. First person signed up is Bruce Yates. Bruce, are you there? Hello, is Anchorage online?
Yes, it's Bruce Yates.
Hi, Bruce.
Morning.
Go right ahead.
I'm the representative from a coalition in Anchorage called the Anchorage State Communities Coalition. We are 18-plus members from a diverse group from areas around the municipality throughout. We represent businesses, hospitals, local and state injury prevention departments such as the Division of Maternal and Child Care, Public Health Department, the municipality, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I myself work as a prevention specialist with the Anchorage School District. We very much support HB 11. And consider it a priority in making Anchorage a safer place to live. My work experience is with 7 years as a prevention specialist dealing with alcohol and drug abuse prevention, violence prevention, doing whatever is necessary to create safe and healthy kids, including injury prevention work, within the municipality for 7 years, and then another 7 years prior to that statewide. I work with teens and been working with teens for the last 14 years, including a number of SAD projects, which is Students Against Drinking and Driving, throughout the state. I've personally seen and know about injuries and deaths that take place every year within our high schools or with high school students. They are without a doubt the highest risk age group that we have to deal with in the municipality and again, apparently statewide. I want to go over quickly just a couple of things that I've discovered by looking at some of our highway safety statistics. That other than senior citizens in Anchorage, teenagers and young adults 15 and 24 years of age are involved in more motor vehicle deaths than any other age group. In 1994, 14 to 19-year-old vehicle drivers and passengers were involved in 2,126 reported, that means there's a lot more obviously, Anchorage traffic crashes, sustained 655 injuries ranging from minor to fatal. In 1995, nationally, the the rate of alcohol involvement in fatal crashes was 3 1/3 times higher at night than during the day. They said 22.3% versus 18.8%. For all crashes, the alcohol involvement rate is nearly 5 times as high at night, 14% versus 3%. In 1995, 32% of all fatal crashes during the week were alcohol-related, compared to 54% on weekends. For all crashes, the alcohol involvement rate was 5% during the week and 11% during the weekend. Teenage drivers are consistently overrepresented in all of these statistics. I just want to start by saying that things are not the same as when you and I were a teenager in high school. Teens are different nowadays in many ways. One of the ways that this high-risk population gets increasingly more high-risk is by their lack of personal self-control. They are more impulsive today than they were in the past. They have less decision-making skills today than they have in the past. More teens are affected from birth because of parents' use of drugs. These are drugs, many kids today are drug-affected kids that can very well pass the driver's test. They have greater use of alcohol and drugs at an earlier age than ever before. They're developing behaviors that make it the norm for many kids, and I certainly don't want to say all teens, but many kids, higher and higher rates, are using alcohol and other drugs as a normal part of their life. And of course, the evening time is especially high-risk time. They have greater rates of depression, which is oftentimes taken out on themselves without even caring about what they do. With the use of a vehicle, that becomes a means to be recklessly driving and possibly even suicidal. Graduate licensing has been a success in other states, and we certainly support it and want it to be a success here in our state. We know enough about this business of prevention to take a look at. We've got kids getting ticketed and being involved in, if nothing else, minor crashes. This is a predictor of greater problems down the road. Graduating licensing will be a way to deal with these most high-risk kids. Let's be reasonable. Let's weed out the kids that are most high-risk so that we can do something with their driver's license and prevent them from continuing on with their driver's license that they'll have for the rest of their life. And with that, I'll make that my closing remarks.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your comments. Are there any questions for Bruce? If not, the next person we have to testify is Marty Greeson, the executive director of MAD. Marty, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's great to be here. I want to share that I have a background of over 20 years' experience working in the victim service field, where predominantly I've spent time providing crisis intervention and death notifications or critical injury notifications to family members and loved ones of many youth involved in driving crashes. Very difficult thing to do, and it is a life-altering, traumatic event for families. Losing a child is often, it's very difficult, and sometimes parents and loved ones never get over it. I'd like to emphasize a couple of notes from my support letter, according to National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. 16 and 17-year-old drivers are involved in more than twice the average number of crashes per mile driven as our experienced adult drivers. Those crashes occur most frequently between midnight and 5 a.m. States which have placed certain restrictions on driver's licenses have shown sharp declines in the number of crashes and fatal crashes involving 16-year-olds during restricted hours. And to emphasize also what Bruce is saying about the youth and the immature choices that they may make with the ready access to drugs and alcohol, which further impact their immature, inexperienced driving abilities and their judgment. That's all.
Thank you very much, Marty. Are there any questions for Marty? If not, thank you for appearing this morning. And the last person in Anchorage is Peggy Hayashi.
Yes, actually there are others here, but yes, I'm here.
All right.
I am the state coordinator for Alaska Safe Kids, which is an injury prevention group of people, part of the National Safe Kids Coalition that Dr. C. Everett Koop heads up in Washington, D.C. We identify injuries and try to do something about them in our young people. In Alaska, we have close to over 100 agencies that participate in this group to reduce childhood injury and death. We have the largest number of childhood injuries and deaths due to unintentional injury per capita in the nation, in Alaska. And over 50% of unintentional injury deaths in this age group, which is 16 to 20 years he's getting his license this year.
Uh-oh.
And that's pretty scary for me. I also see this young man who's typically a really good kid. He's an A student. He's active in his school. But I see him through peers being pushed into getting a driver's license probably earlier than I know that he's mature enough to get one. I would like to see about 10 more years under his belt, but I know that's not feasible. So I really, really want to stress that this is our opportunity to do something now about the if only we had known. And I've heard that, I can't tell you how many times in the course of 33 years as an emergency nurse. And as a state, we have the chance to do that right now. And that's it.
Thank you very much.
One more person that needs to speak.
Right, I do have, I just got a revised list, and I guess Joan Diamond is there also?
Right.
All right, thank you, Peggy, for participating this morning.
You're welcome. I don't want to repeat, so I'll kind of short in saying, first of all, thank you for having this public hearing. I really appreciate that you schedule it, because I know there's so many things competing for the time. Probably what I want to say in support probably for this bill is that there are very few opportunities, even state statutes, to hold you accountable for a lot of the behavior activities that they do, and this is one of those broad-based kinds of approaches, and it's the motor vehicle crashes that we're trying to reduce. But this provisional license provides a time period where someone this young has a chance to learn some life skills that I don't think they get. A lot of it because parents are so busy, they're not providing it like they used to. But also, where there is now a 3,000-pound weapon, and there is a chance for them to realize the responsibility they have for other people in the car. They are increasing the skills that they have for just judgment and coordination in running this vehicle. And also, I mean, it's going to be their ability to resist a lot of the peer pressures to be young and crazy. So by giving them this provisional license, it's buying them time and a chance to learn those skills. So in the end, I think it will affect a lot of behaviors, not just driving the vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you very much for participating this morning, Joan. We have one more person here in Juneau to testify, Mark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm Chief of the Section of Community Health and Emergency Medical Services, Department of Health and Social Services. I'll be real brief. We do support the legislation. We see this as a step towards better public health because this is a major cause of death and disability in our state, and the rate for teenagers is more than double the rate for all other citizens. And I'm particularly impressed when I look at the studies from states that have adopted similar legislation, and in particular with Oregon reporting that the reduction in crashes for male drivers aged 16 and 17 was 16%. To me, that's pretty impressive. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Are there any questions for Mr. Johnson? That ends the testimony. We should take a couple seconds to look at the fiscal note. Juanita, if you could join us real quick, give us a brief summary of the fiscal note.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Juanita Hensley. Fiscal note indicates total operating cost of $108,000.3. Keeping in mind that $77,000 of that is a federal grant, Alaska and North Carolina, when the National Traffic Highway Safety Administration offered incentives to states to look into a graduated licensing system, Alaska and North Carolina were the only two states at that time that were awarded grants. Our grant totaled $77,000. The $163,000 in program receipts that you see is as a result of the reinstatement fees and the driver license fees for issuing the provisional state driver's license. We have one position on there that we're asking out to be funded by the NRC area, but the rest is all related to the federal grant and to the receipt and expend of that grant.
In summary, it's basically, it looks like to me, it's about a net positive about $120,000 a year. Over.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
I'm sure Representative Kelly can find ways to spend that. All right, thank you, Juanita. What is the will of the committee? Representative Davis?
Chairman, I move that we move House Bill number 11. Individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
There's a motion. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, House Bill 11 has moved from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Green, would you handle
a conflict of interest? But when I was a child, we used horse and buggy, so we.
Mr. Green, would you handle my bill next with the finance committee?
Thank you very much. The next bill up this morning is House Bill 158, and we do have a number of sites online. As I said before, we do have a number of folks signed up to testify. We have this prime sponsor here, Representative Dyson. Please join us.
Thank you, and my aide, Lisa Hawk.
We could keep questions relatively short. Thank you, Juanita, for joining us this morning. Relatively brief for Representative Dyson, so we can get through the teleconference this morning. There are quite a few folks signed up to testify on the bill, and I'd like to be able to at least satisfy their ability to get back to come out so early in the morning and show them a bit of courtesy. So with that, Representative Dyson.
Thank you. I suspect you have my sponsor statement and other information in your packet. This bill is relatively simple. All it does is preclude the public schools in the state from discriminating against students who are part-time and or involved in another school experience. The Constitution, and you'll see a citation from it in the sponsor statement, the Constitution says, this Article 7, Section 1, the legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. The bold there is added by us. And the administrative code provides for part-time students and has done for some 20, 25 years, as I understand it. The top of the Attorney General's office, and in fact, the very people that drafted the part-time student portions of the code, and when they were doing so, they actually planned to make it compulsory, the acceptance of part-time students, but thinking that no school district would act to preclude part-time students, they made it permissive in the code. This bill removes the permissive portion and precludes the option of discriminating against the part-time students. At this point, every school district in the state that we know of or that we've heard back from allows the part-time students, except Anchorage, which has a policy against it. Fairbanks, Matsu, Sitka, Copper Center have a very cooperative relationships with their part-time students there. Matsu, they provide tutoring to those all the other part-time students, the ones that are in correspondence, homeschool, or private schools. They allow access to libraries, any classes the kids want to take, and the others do similarly. The Anchorage School District, and we've included their position papers in their reasons that allowing part-time students into the Anchorage School District could provide a constitutional problem in that a student there who is also going to a private school that has some sectarian ties would invoke a constitutional problem in that there might be a benefit that comes to the private school. And they cite the example that a private school choose to not invest in a chemistry lab or a computer lab and instead send their students off to the public school and therefore save some money. It is our position and the Attorney General's position, Ledge Legal's position, that providing educational opportunities and benefits to a student does not accrue benefits to some other private institution like the school that the kid is going to. The State Board of Education invited us 2 weeks ago and to make a presentation on this bill and unanimously endorsed the concept that public part-time students should not be discriminated against. And they reasoned that the schools are publicly supported, a public asset and a resource, and that there ought to be no class of qualified students in the state who do not have access to that public resource. The teachers in the state do not oppose this. In most of the places except Anchorage, they wholeheartedly work with the students and do not discriminate. To me, it's like, and the only, it appears to me, the only opposition is coming from administrators. I want to be generous, but the reasoning that that allowing part-time students somehow or the other assaults the U.S. Constitution follows a logic trail that I can't even find the end of, let alone the whole trail. The idea that some 9 or 10-year-old child who happens to be involved in another school somewhere produces an assault on the U.S. Constitution escapes me. We had testimony from a mother who said that it was homeschooling, who said, you know, I wanted my child to be able to do some research. The school would not even let my child sit in the school library and read the book for the research for the little deal they were doing in their homeschool. There's a fiscal note, zero fiscal note on this. Representative Elton and I have a side bet on what will happen as a result of this. He thinks that there'll be a net egress of students from the public school system. My bet is that it'll be a net great gain. The Sitka experience, and several others that we've talked to, is that the private home and correspondence school students being in the process of eliminating suspicion and paranoia, and the parents who have reservations about public schools find that here in Alaska particularly, we have an extraordinary talented group of teachers, most of whom are very dedicated, and actually is strengthening school, public schools. I didn't think about it when I first brought this up, but several school administrators said that doing the part-time student option has allowed them to phase children back into school who have been excluded for because of their conduct. So allowing them to come back 1-2 hours a day has allowed a thoughtful, progressive readmittance that to see if the kids have gotten their deportment under control. Any questions?
Thank you, Representative Dyson. Representative Davies.
I recognize we have telecoms, so just real briefly, do you want to touch on the funding issue? How do the students, is there funding that attaches to these students?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Davies. The administrative code, that's ACC 09040, has for over a decade allowed for reimbursement of the foundation formula. And a student who comes, takes 1 hour of class, the school gets a 25% credit towards full time. And it progresses to the point where taking four classes gets 100%. When I first started considering this, I went to the Anchorage School District in November and started discussions with him, and I volunteered to encourage a rewriting of that section in order to get more of a front-end reimbursement so that the first hour gets 30 or 35 percent credit just because of the increased administrative load. These districts that have been doing this for a long time have found no problems in administering it. And by the way, the Mike Ford from Ledge Legal will be here shortly and be able to answer any constitutional and legal questions that are beyond me.
Any other questions for Representative Dyson? If not, thank you very much. And we have, as I said, several sites on teleconference. For those who are participating on teleconference, if you could keep your comments to 4 minutes or thereabouts, so we provide opportunity for everyone to testify this morning. First, we'll go to Petersburg. Miss Shirley Zachary, are you there, Shirley?
I am. Thank you very much for the teleconference. I really do appreciate you, all your hard work over this. We are homeschoolers, and I just got off the phone to the school board, district office, trying to figure out the relationship between the homeschoolers and the school board district office here. And the impression that I'm coming away with is that this is an important bill because it sets down specifics with which the homeschoolers, and I'm coming at it from the homeschool, I realize this involves public school and correspondence school too. Let's see. It has specifics that allows the homeschoolers and the school board to come together and start, I guess, negotiating on how to proceed with having part-time students. And the reason I'm saying that is because up until now, we homeschoolers kind of haven't had a leg to stand on. We haven't known what our rights are. And the comment that was just made by the school board secretary was that they weren't even aware. She said that these bills were going through. And I said, well, would you like me to fax these bills to you so you know what's going on? She says, well, we wouldn't even really keep them on file unless it became law. So they're looking at it from the standpoint of what is actually law. And with these bills coming in, both sides will have a ground basis by which to negotiate on. I don't know if that makes sense. I'm just, in the last couple of weeks, trying to pull this together myself, trying to figure this out, because on the one hand, they have said that nobody has really approached them about part-time schooling. But I have heard homeschoolers say that they have made inquiries about it and been turned down. So I'm sure there's truth on both sides, and that maybe we just need this type of thing to help us pull it together so that we are understanding each other. I don't know if that makes sense, but thank you very much for listening to me.
No, makes a lot of sense, Shirley. Are there any questions for Mrs. Zachary? If not, thanks again for participating. Next, we'll go to Anchorage, Mr. Larry Wiggett.
I've been wanting to
Good morning, Larry.
My name is Larry Wiggins, and I'm the director of government relations for the Anchorage School District.
Cheryl Lee? Go right ahead, Larry. I was just going to tell Cheryl Lee we could still hear.
Hi, thank you. And with me this morning is Pete Parnell, attorney. The Anchorage School District, as of course you know, opposes this bill. Initially, I'd like to begin by saying that we wish to make it absolutely clear that the Anchorage School District schools are open to every school-aged child residing in Anchorage. The district eagerly looks forward to educating every such child. We recognize that for a variety of reasons, some students and parents prefer the educational opportunities provided through private schools as their home or correspondence schooling. We believe that we provide quality schools, and we wish to hope to attract and retain an increasing number of students in our public schools, and that may not be the result of the actions of this bill. The basic reasons behind our opposition to the bill, first of all, is the constitutionality of it, and Mr. Parnell will address that more directly. It is our belief that permitting private students to attend public school classes violates the Alaska's Constitution's prohibitions against providing direct benefits to private schools and appropriating funds for non-public purposes. We understand, too, that this seems to be a murky issue, as we will say, or believe the Anchorage School District will be involved. There's a potential for us to be involved in litigation on the constitutionality of this issue. And it's also, since if this becomes mandatory rather than permissive, we believe the state will also be involved in a lawsuit under this issue. Second, we talked about administrative burden and the information that we provided you in the pack that we gave you earlier on. We've mentioned such things as enrollment, making a differentiation between elementary and secondary students. We talked about we mentioned the fact that we have almost 48,000 students in the Anchorage School District, in addition to the 2,000 homeschool correspondents and private school students that could potentially be picking and choosing from the courses in the Anchorage School District, and essentially downgrading our overall quality of educational program as students seek to enroll in those courses that have higher costs associated to them, such as chemistry and such as computer labs. Third, the issue of local control. We talked about requiring the school district to enroll part-time students violates the concept of local control, taking away the decision-making power of the local school board. In conclusion, in those districts where admission of part-time students is identified as a benefit to both students and the public schools, it may be worth assuming the risk of a constitutional legal challenge. And in conversations that I have, and I did not ask the permission, conversations that I've had with several superintendents over the last few days indicate that there are several school districts out there that perhaps do oppose this legislation, but have not been tracking it. The existing Department of Education regulations allow each district to determine whether the benefits be gained is worth the administrative burden and risk of legal challenge. In a situation which exists in Anchorage with numerous non-public school alternatives, mandating enrollment of part-time students would weaken the public school system and expose the district to a variety of legal challenges and administrative headaches. Under these circumstances, the Anchorage School District strongly believes enactment of HB 158 would constitute bad and likely illegal public policy, despite the laudable concerns which have motivated this proposed legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry, for coming out in support of the bill. Representative Kelly?
I want to make a comment. I've always heard educators say that one of the biggest problems is that they have parents that don't care, and that is the thing that makes their job the most difficult, and that is what is downgrading public education, is that parents aren't involved. This gentleman seems to think that by allowing access to schools where parents, the children who have parents who are willing to either take the time to homeschool their kids or to pay exorbitant costs to send them to private schools that may not offer complete packages, that somehow the addition of those kids into the public school system is going to downgrade education. I think he's way off base, and I'm not exactly sure why he objects to this bill, because that is not a solid ground for objecting to it.
Well, I must confess, I also believe that it appears that the Anchorage School District wants our children, but only if they can get them on a full-time basis, and I have a fundamental problem with that. Also in Anchorage, we have Peter Parnell.
Thank you, Representative Mulder, and members of the committee. I wanted to speak a little bit, if I could, to the constitutional issue, and I realize the committee has received conflicting opinions from various attorneys, and ultimately, if this bill is enacted, we anticipate that somebody's going to file a legal challenge, and ultimately, I assume the Alaska Supreme Court will rule whether it's constitutional or not. The committee should be aware that within the last 2 months, the Supreme Court in Montana, which is a state that is, I suppose, not known for being way out in the liberal category, was faced with a very similar issue. It was different in it. It was a question of whether a school district could voluntarily provide access to public school offerings to part-time students. And the court said that it could not be made mandatory. A majority of that court gave a concurring opinion that went further and said that it would be unconstitutional to permit this to occur. The Montana constitutional provision is similar, although not identical, to the Alaska constitutional provision. And if I can read just very quickly a portion of the reasoning that the court followed, it is as follows. Sectarian schools derive their operating funds, for the most part, from the tuition or church resources. To the extent that a sectarian school determines it cannot afford, for example, a volleyball program or a chemistry lab or a band from these private sources, such schools can shift the financial burden of such programs to the public treasury by sending sectarian school students to the public school volleyball program, chemistry lab, or band. In short, the public school districts end up effectively subsidizing the sectarian school's educational program. This is precisely what the Constitution prohibits. And our belief, my belief, is that if faced with the same issue, the Alaska Supreme Court would come to that conclusion. If I can go on just a bit further, I believe that the practical concern that the Anchorage District has, and maybe it falls into Representative Dyson's best, is that the impact of this legislation in Anchorage will be egress from the public school system rather than ingress, and we base that upon litigation which the district was involved in several years ago, where a number of private school students sought to be permitted to participate in extracurricular activities that this district offered, which the various private school or homeschool situations couldn't accommodate. And it was made very clear by the majority of the plaintiffs in that case that the only reason why the students remained in the school system was to participate on the hockey team or whatever, and that if they were allowed to, they were students who are currently full-time Anchorage School District students, and had the district allowed or been allowed to let them play on, say, on the hockey team, those students would have left the school district and only participated in that one activity. And the belief that the district has is that the net effect will be a reduction in the number of students, as homeschools and private schools pick and choose those things which they can't offer for various financial reasons. Thank you.
Thank you very much for participating this morning, Peter. I know that I've visited quite often with Larry about this issue, and it's something that that we disagree on, but I really appreciate you folks coming forward today and raising the issue. Are there any questions for Mr. Partnow? If not, we'll go on to Kenai. Barbara, and I think your last name is misspelled on here, so I can't pronounce it. Ja?
Ja.
Ja?
The J is like a Y.
Oh, okay. It was. I wasn't sure if it was misspelled or not. Barbara, please please proceed.
Okay. I am Barbara Nya, and I would like you to support House Bill 158, allowing part-time attendance of home and private school students at a public school upon request. I have homeschooled for 11 years, and costs are part of the issue. I'm a tax-paying person who supports the public school system in that way. Over the years, the average cost of our materials ranged from $400 to $700. And I read in the Teaching Home magazine that the national average cost of materials per child runs around $500. Last year, I tried to add animation to my son's chemistry and to try a new approach in math and programming electives, and we spent over $400 in computer programs after consulting with an East Coast company that specialized in educational software. After less than a month, we decided that the programs we had ordered were not what we had hoped for, and I ordered the full set of materials in the usual textbook format. Homeschooling parents want the best options possible for their children and creatively seek them. Our son has taken two welding mini-series courses at the home of a local pipe shop foreman. When he hit a snag in Algebra 2 that I could not help him with, we hired a tutor. And I sat many nights studying geometry so that we could work together if he needed help. This has been the case through the years, that I relearned many things and learned new subjects also for the first time. This is not due to the fact that I have an adult concentration span now and the incentive of wanting to do the best I can for my students.
You were told a few years ago when our son wanted to participate in intramural sports that it was against our Kenai Borough policy. The borough denied this and said that such decisions were made by individual schools. And the school then allowed him into intramural for that year, but said he could not enter their inter-school sport program. And so we found a private school who would cooperate with us in that area and took that alternative. But I would like HB 158 to be interpreted as specifically including extracurricular activity as well. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for joining us this morning, and I apologize for mispronouncing your last name. Also in Kenai, we have Joanne Hardesty. Joanne, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment to begin with in response to the Anchorage School District, speaking about the schools being used for non-public purposes. And as far as I'm concerned, my children are the public, so I didn't understand how that could be considered for non-public purpose. The public is entitled to use the school, so regardless of whether I pay extra as a homeschooler and buy my own curriculum and teach my child in addition to what public schools offer, public schools exist to educate our children regardless of whatever education we as parents choose to provide for them. I think that HB 158 is a bill that shows the value that we place on our child and their education. I see this bill as solidifying a child's right to a well-rounded education. Some homeschools and private schools can't offer everything a school supply, and we may want our children to attend a class at the school, maybe a computer lab or an advanced math or science class, without discrimination. And if my understanding is correct, this bill would allow a child to take those courses. Right now, you know, it appears that the administrative code is weighted in favor of the school, and my understanding is that this bill would instead put the students' best at the forefront and make all the students have equal access to the public school. My hope would be that the students would be able to attend school for academic classes as well as extracurricular activities on a part-time basis. And thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Joanne. Are there any questions for Ms. Hardesty? If not, we'll go to Fairbanks. The first person I've signed up in Fairbanks is Jamie Cox. Are you there, Jamie? All right. The next person I have is Lisa Seitz.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to come and talk to you this morning on this. My name is Lisa Seitz, and I'm a mother of three children. I homeschool them. This is our fifth year, and I'm in favor of this bill, and I think it's going to be very important to us personally. My oldest is just now in junior high, and I'm looking down the road to seeing times that I'm not going to be able to, you know, always independently meet the needs of the interests that she has. And being a public taxpayer, like some of the other folks that have spoken, I just really want to know that that option is there for the things that we are providing for others, that they're also there for our children, even though it's on a part-time basis. I lead the Interior Homeschool Association in Fairbanks. A lot of families belong to that, and I have to say that here in Fairbanks, I really do not know if the situation is one that they're completely open to this, because the folks that I know that have utilized the school system, they're either transitioning back into full-time or taking enough courses to be considered, you know, which is four courses to be considered full-time. So I hear that the statements are being said, you know, that Fairbanks is agreeable to this. That is very possible. I don't know of anyone that has personal experience with that, and unfortunately I don't think there's anyone here that has that. One of my concerns with reading the bill was the fact that it, you know, it stated part-time enrollment and did not give a definition, and I was wanting to be sure that that meant anything, you know, from one class on, if we only wanted to take a foreign language class, for example. I do notice in the sponsor statement that there is the formula is stated, you know, that it, in one course that it equals 0.25 of the full-time equivalent, so I'm assuming that this does mean that my student could take this one class, and I'm really concerned with that, because I don't want to have to, in order to take a foreign language class, have to qualify, you know, for some other number in a formula, like have to take two, excuse me, or something to that effect. I was concerned as far as earlier when I heard some of the folks speak on legal ramifications, that I really feel like discriminating against these part-time students opens us up for more legal ramifications than not allowing them, because it is a public access, and we are the public in paying taxes for this. And I also want
for the wording on the bill. There are some of us that have a concern, and I hope I can make this clear. I don't write these kinds of bills, so I hope you can understand what I'm getting at. On line number 5, it does state that says of the section, a governing body shall, upon request, allow a child, including a child. In place of the word allow a child, I would prefer to see not deny a child or not deny access. And my only reason for stating that is that, you know, as we know, as we go on down the road, things that become past seem to be used as the precept for something else to come. And I don't really want that thing as far as allow to state that, then since they're just allowing it, something that can be taken away from us. And I'm not sure if I'm real clear on that. I'd be sure to try to elaborate if you have a question. I would be more comfortable with not saying that it's allowed, because I feel as taxpayers, technically we're allowed. We just want to state clearly that we are not being denied or discriminated against. And that is really all that I needed to say. Thank you very much.
Lisa, thank you for participating. Representative Davies has a question for you, and in relation to your question about allow versus not deny, we do have our legal counsel here, and if Mr. Partnow is still up in Anchorage, we are going to, at the end of teleconference testimony, have a bit of discussion about the constitutional question. So, and we also, at that time, Lisa, asked him about the terminology of allow versus deny. Representative Davies?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Lisa, this is John Davies down here. I just wanted to say that it's my understanding that the definition of part-time here does include one or more classes, so I don't think you need to worry about that one. And I read the allow the way to mean to not, that they can't deny, but we'll check that out for you and make sure.
Also, in relation to the question you had as it pertains to the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, we do have a letter in our packet signed by Dr. Nicholas Stayrock, in which he states, for the past several years, Fairbanks has allowed part-time students, both elementary and secondary, to attend schools/classes in our schools. These students are coded as part-time, and if they are enrolled during our October account period, are included in our official student enrollments. In summary, he said, your proposed House Bill number 158 would not cause our district to do anything different from what we have already been doing for years. So from my reading of their letter, they are not opposed and had, in fact, already been doing what the bill is proposing to be done. So, but please let us know if there's something, if you have information to the contrary.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Next in Fairbanks is Ruth Ewing.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Dyson, and also recognition and appreciation to our hardworking Interior delegation, Representative Kelly Terrio and Derek Davies. I'd just like to make a comment or address to the Anchorage School District's testimony. I make a counter proposition to those who oppose HB 158. Public schools that deny access to students need to also give up that money. Those students' families do not need to invest in the schools. Let the money follow the child, as stated by the Alaska Department of Education, SB 134, or during our testimony there. I support this bill because here in Fairbanks, we have homeschooled for 6 years. We have found that homeschoolers have been at the mercy of an individual teacher or administrator and red tape as to whether we can access public school facilities. Even though my husband and I pay more than $3,000 in school tax, currently it is completely up to the benevolence of the school authority we are directed to. For example, our last superintendent was adamantly opposed to homeschoolers, and principals followed his example. The present superintendent is more friendly toward us. Who can say what the next one would want or direct? This bill sets a standard on our behalf where the state is not so much the big brother. Again, I propose to public schoolers who want to deny us access that they let go of our money and let our money follow our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth. Are there any questions for Ruth this morning? If not, the next person I have signed up is Sharon Smith in Fairbanks. Are you there, Sharon?
Yes, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity that you've given us. The Smith family supports HB 158. I'm very grateful and thankful to Representative Fred Dyson for introducing HB 158 and for all his colleagues involved with it. I appreciate this legislation introduced to end discrimination against homeschoolers. As we all know, home education is phenomenally sweeping our nation, and the enrollment numbers of students attending homeschooling in Alaska is growing by leaps and bounds. Charter schools are becoming more and more popular. Some families also choose to educate their children via correspondence. By whatever means, an Alaska family chooses to educate their children, whether it be homeschooled, private schools, charter schools, or educated by correspondence. We cannot and shall not discriminate against any students from attending public schools in any way, shape, or form. After all, we need to be reminded that our tax dollars
two daughters, which are ages 10 and 12 now, and we just need to let you know that we appreciate the intent of this bill, and we will go forward. And we appreciate you, you all down there working hard for us. Thanks again.
Thank you, Sharon. Are there any questions for Sharon? If not, the last person I have signed up in Fairbanks is Glenn Prax. Glenn, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
And thank you for taking the time. I support this bill because it promotes establishing partnerships between parents and schools. There's thousands of parents already that are taking responsibility for providing their own children's education, but some of them lack the confidence in certain subjects or maybe the resources to provide the equipment to get as good of education as they could on their own. So they'd like to have the opportunity for their kids to take advantage of what's available for some subjects, but then it's perfectly, their parents are perfectly willing to provide education for other subjects. And I think the legislature should support this concept because it improves the quality of education, it improves the bond between parents and their children, which is a good thing, and then lastly, it saves the state a considerable amount of money by encouraging and being friendly towards parents that provide their own education. If the state is there to help out in some areas where they might not be able to, but they do allow parents to provide education otherwise, it saves the state a lot of money in the long run. And so it improves education, and at the same time, it saves the state money. So I think it's a real good bill, and I encourage you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Glenn. Are there any questions for Mr. Prax? If not, Glenn is the last person I have signed up on the teleconference on the sheet before me. Are there any other folks out there on teleconference who wish to testify? If not, we'll close that part of the comment. We do have with us this morning Mike Ford, legal counsel for the bill and also for the legislature. Mike, in relation to the questions of constitutionality, I know you've drafted an opinion. Could you share that information with the committee?
Yes. For the record, my name is Mike Ford. I'm an attorney with the Division of Legal Services. We have looked at the question of constitutional problems in relation to the bill. We concluded that there are no problems, and that position is also supported by the Attorney General. Recently, we had we attended a meeting of the State Board of Education, and Jan Levy attended that also and made the same position that we do. We do recognize there is an argument here under the Sheldon Jackson case. The court did look at what constitutes a direct benefit. We believe that under that decision, as well as earlier decision of the court, this kind of relationship between public school students and the private school system in the state does not constitute a direct benefit. We do have examples of direct benefits. Such as the Sheldon Jackson case dealt with one. The legislature created a program where the state would give a check to people who attended private colleges. Now there was a stipulation there. They had to use that money to attend the private school. So the argument was, well, it's not a direct benefit because we're giving the money to a private individual, and what they do with it is up to them. Well, the stipulation was, of course, they had to attend the private school. The court said, well, no, it's still a direct benefit. It's still money that goes to a private institution, and it's prohibited by our Constitution. Now we know that our Constitution distinguishes between direct and indirect benefits. So what the question here is this a direct or indirect benefit? The examples we have of indirect benefits, I think, support the conclusion that this is an indirect benefit. No money flows to a private school here. The court used the example of one direct benefit that is allowed. For example, if the private school catches fire, the fire department responds, and that's a very direct benefit to the private school. Does our Constitution mean they don't respond to the fire? No, it doesn't mean that. That's a benefit that's available to everyone in the state, without regard to who you are. In the same sense, our public schools are required by our Constitution to be open to all children of the state, without regard to who you are. And if we accept the contention of the Anchorage School District, what we're really doing is crafting exceptions under our Constitution. You can attend public school, but if you also attend private school, then you fall into a class that's prohibited from attending the public school. I think that is incorrect. So the benefit we're talking about here, in a number of senses, I think, is very difficult to prove. We're assuming that private schools are going to be benefited. Well, that assumes that they're not offering the same classes. That assumes that, in fact, students are going to be combining the two to achieve some result. And even assuming that's correct, it's a benefit that flows indirectly, not directly, to the private school. So that's it in a nutshell.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Representative Davies?
Does Anchorage make the argument based on what the child is doing elsewhere, or do they just make a blanket requirement that if you're going to attend, it has to be full-time?
I believe it's because of your attendance at the private school. But you should ask them that. I mean, that's my understanding, is that you lose your ability to attend public school by your attendance at the private school.
So they do advocate that it's a constitutional issue.
Correct.
It's providing a direct or indirect vote.
Their position is that if you allow these students to attend public school, that you are conferring a direct benefit onto a private school.
Mr. Partnow, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here.
You'd concur with that summary?
Not exactly. I think at one point when Mr. Dyson's bill initially started in the education committee, there was a question about whether it should be its scope should be limited only to homeschool and correspondence, or whether it should be kept open to everybody, including students who attended private sectarian or non-sectarian private schools. And the issue, the constitutional issue, I believe, is clearer. It's more clearly unconstitutional when you're talking about private school students versus, say, correspondence students. With regards to correspondence students, the question constitutionally is whether the correspondence student or the homeschool is viewed as a one or two student, quote, educational institution. And if it were, the same problem would exist, but it's not. I think it's not as clear of a constitutional problem in that situation. The other constitutional problem is what's called the entanglement problem, that if a public school district has a student who's showing up only for, say, one course a day, in terms of it puts the public school in a situation where it needs to check to find out what that student is doing for the rest of the other three quarters of the day, and whether they're enrolled or not, whether they're in a proper program, and that is going to require a lot of what's called entanglement, which under another line of cases is another reason why type of interaction is indeed unconstitutional.
Representative Kelly, you have a question?
Yes. Whose job, if the Constitution provides that there shall be free and public education for all, whose job is it to enforce that? I understand that it's the education system's job to provide the education, but I would be curious, whose job is it to enforce when it is discovered that someone is not being provided free public education?
Mr. Ford or Mr. Partnow?
Mr. Chairman, when we have rights guaranteed under our Constitution, it's generally the court's responsibility to flesh out those rights. We do have a provision in our Constitution which says the legislature shall maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. In this situation, if the question becomes, does that require you to allow part-time enrollment? Then it would be up to the court to say that is, in fact, our interpretation of that provision. So when you say enforcement, once the court made that decision, then it would be, of course, it would require compliance by the people.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was asking is that I believe Mr. Partnow said that it was, if a child was attending just one course or some combination there, that it would be their job to find out what other courses they were getting. And I don't know, and I could be wrong. It doesn't seem to me that it's the education institution's job to see to it that everybody gets a free and public education, but it is their job to provide that free and public education. So.
This is Peter Partnow speaking. What I was referring to, there are also compulsory education laws that require school-age students to be attending school, and the situation that the district has now, if the student is there and enrolled, we know that they're meeting the compulsory education requirements because they're there. If a public school district has a student who's only showing up for one class a day, they don't know whether the it could be that that's the only class that a 14-year-old student is attending, and without further checking, there's no way to verify whether compulsory education requirements are being met.
Mr. Partnow, or Larry, if you're still there, what is the intention of the school district? Should this bill pass, is the school district, Anchorage School District, intending to allow part-time students to attend the school, or will they immediately challenge it in court?
President Mulder, it is my understanding at the current time that the Anchorage School District will follow the letter of the law. We anticipate outside challenges to be filed relative to this law if it does pass, either coming from within parents and school district, the ACLU, or others.
Larry, there's a question. Are part-time students attending Anchorage School District currently?
No.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Kelly?
What was the,
this is a case that everyone should know about. What was the arrangement that Trajan Langdon was under?
If I can speak to that, he attended a stellar school, which is an alternative program that was set up that doesn't have any interscholastic activities of any sort, and so students who attend stellar are allowed to participate at interscholastic activities at their home school. And so there are many students. I had a son who went to stellar and played basketball at West. Unfortunately, he wasn't Trajan.
College gets expensive then, doesn't it?
You're calling us from North Carolina. Thank you.
All right. Are there any further questions?
One last thing. Kelly? I don't mean to dominate time, but it's to your bet to Representative Elton, and that is that I went to school at a Catholic school, and all my brothers and sisters went to a Catholic school. And when I had my own children, there was a brief period of time where they went to public school in Kenai, and came back to Fairbanks and went back into the same Catholic school I was in. It was kind of a family tradition. However, when we're down here, my wife goes through the correspondence studies program from the Fairbanks North Star School District. What we have found through this interaction with the Fairbanks North Star School District, they got a pretty decent curriculum. I am now questioning whether I really need to spend the money to send my kid to Catholic school. As much as I enjoy all the other benefits of Catholic school, it is a tremendous expense. But as you said, will there be a net egress or gain? I think there may be a gain from my own personal experience. We're having a discussion right now. Do we need to be in public school now, or in private school, now that we have experienced the Fairbanks North Star Borough curriculum, which is far better than I thought it was?
I apologize to the members for drawing out the debate here a little bit. However, I thought it was really important to put on the record the conflict here in relation to the constitutional question, and to demonstrate the fact that we did have good discussion about the issue and that no one was confused on that particular point. I would note for the record that there is a zero fiscal note attached to the bill, as well as the letter attached to the packet from Shirley Holloway, Commissioner of the Department of Education, and she did note that during its, and I quote, during its April 7th meeting, 1997, the Alaska State Board of Education, by unanimous vote, voted to support House Bill 158. So with that, Representative Davies?
Thank you. I'm sorry, I've been sort of attending a couple other issues too at the same time here, but did we have any discussion of the word allow?
That's right. Mike, could you give comment in relation to the question of allow versus not deny?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we try to write all our...